Series entitled The Faces of Grace. And if you look on the cover there of your Creek Guide, you'll notice all of those faces that are placed there. The reality of it is this: when it comes to this series that I'm about to embark on all through the month of June, every one of us needs grace. If you haven't noticed, if you miss the theme of worship today, it's all about grace. How many of you picked up on that, right? Man, it's all about God's grace. And I want you to know, if you're in here and you're young, you need grace. If you're old, you need grace. If you are single, you need grace. If you are married, you need grace. If you're a man, you need grace. And all the ladies said, yeah. And if you're a woman, you need grace, all right? The truth is, we are the faces of grace. Everyone in this room needs grace, every one of us. It's not just that person who chose to go to the lake and not to church today. It's not that person who lives down the road from you, whose family's falling apart and marriage is falling apart. They're not the ones that need grace. It's not that person you read about in the news. It's not someone you saw on some awards show that's just acting all crazy. They're not the ones that need grace. We need grace. Folks, the point of this message is we are the faces of grace. Now, you're going to see over the next couple of weeks, I'm going to use that idea of faces of grace in two different ways. One is we are the recipients of grace, and we need loads of it. In fact, we need God's amazing grace. But also, God has given us the opportunity to be the mediators of His message of grace to others. And so we're the faces of grace. We are the faces of grace on the receiving end. We are the faces of grace on the giving end. I want to start this series with a message entitled Grace for the Condemned. Grace for the Condemned. Not grace for the person we think might feel guilty. Grace for the condemned. Let me remind you right up front what grace is. Here's what grace is. Put it on the screen. It's God's favor towards those who are unworthy. Grace is God's favor towards those who are unworthy. That's each and every one of us. Every one of us needs God's grace. Now, you heard Keith read a few minutes ago from John chapter 8. It's the story we're looking at today in John chapter 8. It's the woman that was caught in adultery. She was caught red-handed. She was condemned. But when she encountered Christ, she received His grace. And that's what we need to look at today as we think about it. She was caught in adultery. And let me tell you this, as I begin this message today, and I'm going to give you some statistics on adultery, I want you to know today that you could take out adultery and insert any other sin, and it's the same message. It could be any other sexual sin. It doesn't have to be adultery. It could be homosexuality. It could be transgenderism. It could be anything. And insert. And they need grace. They need God's amazing grace. Your sin could be something else. It could be gambling. It could be alcohol. It could be drugs. It could be this. It could be that. It doesn't matter. Take whatever sin we're about to look at out, insert your sin, and you need grace. Take whatever sin we're going to talk about today, pull it out, the adultery idea, and insert the sin of your neighbor, that one that you're next to, that one that's condemned, and insert grace. Let's go back as we think about grace as God's favor towards those who are unworthy. Let's first of all look at it in our salvation. Look at Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8 to 10. This is God's grace, the unmerited favor towards those who are unworthy. Here it is as it relates to our salvation. Paul says, "For it is by grace you have been saved through faith." Grace saves us through faith. "And this is not of yourselves, because it is only a gift from God." Verse 9, "Not by works, so that no one can boast." Man, no one stands here today as saved, a saved believer, one who is forgiven by sins, patting themselves on the back, saying, I did it. Because we didn't. We had nothing to do with it. God did it all. It says, we are saved by the grace of God. This not of yourselves, it is a gift of God. Not by works, so that no one should boast. Because if it was by works, trust me, we would boast. Then look at verse 10. So now God hasn't just saved us without a purpose. He saved us with a purpose. What is the purpose? Verse 10. For we are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do. Man, we are, regardless of our checkered past, our checkered present, whatever it is, when God saves us and forgives us, He appoints us to an amazing grace-filled future. He has created us. That word handiwork, there in the original language is the Greek word poema. In other words, God is writing us as His poem. Now, let me tell you, if you look in my life and you look in the lives of those around you, there are some beautiful stanzas that God wrote in my life. But you look back in my life years ago, there are some stanzas that I wrote that they're only worthy of one thing, grace. Some things that I did, some things that you did, that I wrote some things, and it's worthy of nothing but grace. Nothing but grace. But one of those appointed works that God has for us is a ministry called grace and reconciliation. You see it in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Put it up on the screen. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. God, listen to this, was reconciling the world to Himself. What does it mean to reconcile? That means two people that were hostile towards each other, that were enemies toward each other, their backs were turned to each other. You reconcile. Anybody try to reconcile your kids? You go in a room and the kids are fighting, they're arguing, they're what? And you're like, you're brothers and sisters, why are you fighting? Or you're this or you're that. Or sometimes that's the husband and wife, right? Why are you fighting? You're trying to reconcile. You're trying to bring them together. How did God reconcile us to Himself through Christ? Here it is. Notice. By not counting people's sins against them. Guess what that's called? That's called grace. Everybody say grace. Man, every one of us, if we are saved, it's because God chose not to count your sins against you. Do we understand that? It's not that God didn't have to count sins against me. God chose not to. Man, that's grace. I'm a face of grace. That's what it's all about. I am a face of grace. We are the faces of grace. And as we think about God reconciled the world to Himself in Christ Jesus, not counting people's sins against them. Grace for the condemned. We're guilty. We're guilty. But notice, it doesn't stop there. And He, God, has committed to us what? The message. What's the message? The message of reconciliation. Now think about this. God's message to the world is a message of reconciliation. That He is not counting people's sins against them. That's grace. Now, God gives us that message. He preaches that message through us to our neighbors, to those we work with, those that we encounter, those we have relationships with, those we have friendships with. God does all of that. Listen, He has committed to us the message of reconciliation. After I realize that I'm a Christian because of one thing, God chose not to count my sins against me, and He has given me that same message. Look at verse 20. We are therefore Christ's ambassadors, as though God were making His appeal through us. And then Paul says, we implore you on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God. Our message is to go to the condemned and offer them God's amazing grace. I'm going to say that again. Our message is to go to the condemned and offer them God's amazing grace. Now, I know that as I broach the subject today of adultery, that there are many people in here that this is like reopening a wound. It's pulling a scab back off. And I want you to know that's not the purpose. Because as I said a few minutes ago, everybody in this room, take out her sin, insert your sin, you're going to receive the same message from Christ today. Grace for the condemned. And so the point of the story is really not what the sin is. The sin doesn't matter. The adultery aspect really doesn't matter. It's Christ's message. That's truly what matters. And I want you to know, what you see here is an encounter between guilt and grace. There's no question she's guilty. There's no question that we are guilty. But I want you to know it's also hard. It is difficult to harmonize justice and mercy, isn't it? Isn't it difficult? I mean, it's hard. We understand, we know the law. How many of you have ever heard of something called the Ten Commandments? You familiar with those a bit? Man, when someone goes and breaks a Ten Commandment, man, we think justice. And we're going to see here today, Jesus says mercy. Jesus says mercy. So as we look and we think, what does it look like for us if we are going to be ambassadors for Christ? What does it look like for us as we deliver Christ's message? I want to give you four thoughts. And so hopefully if you're in a position or a place where you are needing to, or you will in the near future or sometime in the days ahead, you need to confront someone about their sin, here's how you would do it. I'm going to give you four thoughts. If you are the person who could be standing before Jesus and the Pharisees guilty in the story because of some sin, insert your sin, then hear the words of Jesus to you from beginning to end. Thought number one is this: if we are going to be truly, if we're truly going to be ambassadors for Christ in reconciling others to God, here's what we have to do. We must learn to imitate Christ's wisdom. We have to have wisdom. Write that down. We have to have wisdom in relating to the world and living in the world and living in the world that we live in. Look at John chapter 8, verse 3. Notice Jesus has, he's here. If you go back and look at verse 2, Keith read it earlier. In verse 2, Jesus is doing what he's always doing. Jesus is a rabbi, a teacher of the law. He's gone to a public place and he's beginning to teach God's word. And so he's sitting there and he's teaching God's word. Verse 2, it says, at dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people were gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. All right, that's verse 2. Now let's go back to the slide we were just on. All right, picking up verse 3. There we go. He says, the teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group. Now listen to this. They caught her in adultery, brought her in. Jesus is teaching. So listen, it's not just Jesus and a few Pharisees and this woman. It would be like this group right here. And all of a sudden, somebody in our church, or several men or several women in our church, drugged someone right here in the middle of my teaching and said, Pastor, this woman, this man, this person has been caught in adultery. The law says stone her. What do you say? Let me tell you what your pastor would say. I'm so smart, I would go, commercial break. Right? I mean, that's how public this was. So don't think she's just rolling down the road. No, he's teaching. He's sitting in it, and they brought her up. And imagine this woman, just broken and beaten, and they drag her in, and she's standing right there. Can you imagine what everybody's thinking? All the guys that are sitting there going, I don't know her. Some of them saying, I do. A lot of ladies in the room going, I knew she was that way. I've always thought that about her. That's a terrible woman, by the way. I apologize. No, not your terrible woman. My interpretation of a woman. Ooh, grace. They made her stand before the group right here and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of adultery." Look at verse 5. "In the law of Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. What do you say?" Now listen to this, wisdom, verse 6. They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing Jesus, but Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. So they were using these questions as a basis to entrap Jesus. Well, how are they trying to entrap Jesus? Two ways, really. One, if Jesus says, "Listen, I just want to give her grace, y'all let her go, hey, everything's okay," then they immediately do what? They accuse Jesus of negating the law. "We told you this guy was a lawbreaker. We told you he was a friend of sinners. He ate with tax collectors. He's doing all of this stuff." And they're saying, "See, we told you. This guy doesn't love the law of Moses. That was the way that he offered grace." The second way, if he says, "Yeah, stone her," and he picks up a rock, then immediately the Pharisees and the teachers of the law will head to the Romans, because although the Romans had given the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the leaders in Israel a lot of power, ultimately crucifixion or execution was a reserved right that could only be authorized by the Romans. So they would have gone to the Romans and said, "Hey, by the way, this Jesus we've been talking to you about, he's out there, he just encouraged others to execute someone. He's trying to set himself up above the law." So either way, however Jesus responds, he's in a trap. So Jesus responds in a very smart way. It says he kneels down, turns his back to them, and begins to write on the ground. What was he saying? I don't know. But let me remind you that she was caught, she was condemned, and she was guilty. Adultery is one of the big 10, right? Look at Exodus chapter 20. Put the next two verses up on the screen. Look at it. "You shall not commit adultery." I'm reminded of an old joke where Moses had gone up on the mountain for a long time, and he come down from the mountain, and he said, "Hey, guys, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news. The good news is I've been negotiating with God on a bunch of commandments. I've whittled him all the way down to 10. The bad news is adultery's still in there." So it's that serious. It's that serious. Now look at Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 20, verse 10 says, "If a man commits adultery with another man's wife, both the adulterer and the adulteress must be put to death." Well, that calls in another question. Well, if she was caught in adultery, where is he, right? How many of you know it takes two to tango? That's in the Bible. Y'all act like y'all can't shake your head to that. Yeah. Takes two. And it says she was caught. Well, if you caught her, who was the caught he? And why aren't the caught they standing there, right? There should be two of them standing there. So Jesus immediately knows this is a trap. This is a trap. He goes, if I say forgive her, then you're going to accuse me, and rightly so, of negating the law. He goes, if I say execute her, you're going to go turn me into the Roman authorities. And he goes, by the way, this whole thing seems like a bunch of trumped up charges, because where is the he? If she was caught. So the first thing we have to understand, especially in the world that we live in, folks, if you haven't been noticing more and more today, if you haven't been noticing, you're unplugged. It seems as though we're moving more and more to a society where every sexual sin is considered okay. And folks, at a certain point, we are going to have to be willing to stand up, to be bold enough, but to at the same time offer grace to the condemned. And we have to do it first and foremost with Christ's wisdom, because I'll tell you what, I'm getting it more and more, and you're going to be getting it more and more. When someone says, when you tell someone you're a Christian, you're going to say, well, what do you think about this whole homosexual same-sex marriage? You better have wisdom. What do you think about this whole transgenderism that Obama says we now have to, you better have some wisdom in how you respond. Now, wisdom doesn't mean you back away from the truth. Because that brings us to the second thought. We must imitate Christ's wisdom. He knelt down and began to draw on the dirt. But we also must imitate his words. Look at Christ's words. John chapter 8, it says, when they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone. Again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first. They were smarter. The older dude said, yeah, he pretty much got us. The young guys were looking, well, now what do we say now? The older guy says, best thing we can do is leave. Exit the premises. Because remember, here's the beauty of this whole scene, is these ones who had been putting yokes and burdens on all the people's necks about the Pharisaical law and their 633 laws they had extrapolated out of the Ten Commandments that you can't do this and 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 you can't do this, and if your ox falls in a ditch on Sunday, you can't get it out till Monday. I mean, all this stupid stuff. And they built themselves up as representatives of God, and they bring Jesus in. They bring in front of Jesus a woman caught in adultery, the perfect trap. And Jesus just smokes them. And the old dude said, look at the young guys. I told you that wasn't going to work. And they begin to scamper out. Now, as they move away, now listen. Again, he stooped down, wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman who still was standing there. How many of you would like to know what Jesus wrote on the ground? So would I. I've been studying them for the last couple of weeks, and here are the best answers of what Jesus wrote on the ground. Some believe that Jesus actually began to write on the ground the sins of the men that were there. Just begin to write down. He looked up at, oh, so-and-so, Rabbi so-and-so, and he goes, yeah, this one's for you, buddy. He looked at so-and-so and says, oh, by the way, this one's for you. Maybe that's why the older ones left first, is because they had more sin in their life. So some think he wrote down the sins of those who were there. Some believe that perhaps Jesus may have looked at this woman who was probably a little loose, and he just began to write down the names of all the men that he knew who had been with her. And as he began to write. Others believe, now notice, he began to write. He stood up and talked, and he knelt down and wrote again. So he was writing a lot. Some believe he was perhaps writing the law, or perhaps even this verse from Deuteronomy. He put up Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 7. Perhaps Jesus was writing down the words. This would actually flow with the context. The hands of the witnesses must be the first in putting him to death. So maybe Jesus was saying, well, you know what the law says? The law says, if you are truly a witness to this, you be the first to throw the stone. I love what one commentator, John Calvin, he says, you know what? I don't believe Jesus wrote anything in the ground. He says, I believe he turned his back, and it says he turned his back, and he says he was just doodling, just to infuriate them. Can you imagine Jesus over there? He turns around. Tic-tac-toe, X, O, X, O, X, O. Cat, again. Oh, by the way, whichever one of you is without sin, let it rip. X, O, X, O, X, O. Cat, gah! Calvin said that would have infuriated him more than anything. That, in other words, he was turning his back on him and saying, you're not even worthy of me addressing you other than to say this, hey, sinless one, let it rip. We have to learn to imitate his wisdom. We have to learn to imitate his words, but now learn to imitate his grace. Write that down. Imitate his grace. Put it up there. Go to the next point. Imitate his grace. John 8, chapter 10. Then Jesus straightened up again, and this is the first time he addresses her. Now listen, a majority of the text is Jesus addressing, listen to this, the accusers. He wants to know where their heart is, where their life is, where their minds are. And that's what we need to understand. When we begin to go and someone else is coming and they're bringing someone's sins in front of us, we need to, before we even address that sin, we need to address their heart. Where's your heart in this matter? Where's your heart in this matter? And so Jesus straightens up after doodling cat. By the way, I don't know what he wrote. Jesus straightened up and asked the woman, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? No one, sir. Then neither do I condemn you. Now remember, this was a public setting with people here. That probably means there were some who were looking at that woman thinking, that could be me. My guess is there are some in this room who are sitting there saying, that could be me. Some men, some women. Maybe it's not this sexual sin, but it's another sin. Jesus says, then neither do I condemn you. Grace for the condemned. We have to imitate Christ's wisdom. We have to imitate his words. We have to imitate his grace. But let me tell you what, when Jesus said, neither do I condemn you, I want you to write this down real quickly. Put it up on the screen. Forgiveness is not a license to sin. Jesus didn't say, neither do I forgive you, so finish what you started. Jesus didn't say, now go back to your lifestyle. Jesus didn't say that at all. Matter of fact, Romans chapter 6, Paul even talked about some people who do that. Boy, they say, I'm saved by grace, I'm saved by God's grace, and so now that I know I'm saved, once and all for saved, I was saved as a kid, I'll be saved at the end, man, I can live life however I want to. Paul addressed that very clearly. He says, what shall we say then? Shall we go on sinning so that grace may increase? Verse 2 says, by no means. Man, in our lives, we have to understand that if I've been forgiven, it is a tall task and an important task for us that when I sin, I receive God's grace. But after I receive God's grace, that I make appropriate changes to my life. Boy, that's what Paul says. What shall we say then? Shall we go on sinning that grace may increase? By no means. Love Psalm 85, verse 10. You may have never seen this verse before. Love and faithfulness meet together. Righteousness and peace kiss each other. What a thought. God's love and our faithfulness meet together. Righteousness, listen to this, and peace kiss. What a great thought. That means God's grace in full force and my best always covered by grace. What an incredible thought. So thought number one, if we're going to be Christ ambassadors to those who are lost and those who are sinners and those who are hurting and those who could be brought before us, the first thought is this: we must imitate Christ's wisdom. We must imitate his words. We must imitate his grace. And here's number four. You ready for it? We must imitate his mission. Write that down. Remember, we are ambassadors of Christ. Imitate his mission. What was his mission? He says, then neither do I condemn you. Jesus declared, go now and leave your life of sin. This was grace for the condemned. And in this room, we are the faces of grace. Whatever it is, I want you to know God's grace covers all your sin. But the challenge of Christ is this, neither do I condemn you. Now leave your life of sin. Every person in this room at some point in their life has had a checkered past. Some in this room right now, you have a pretty checkered present. If Jesus were standing here today, he would say, neither do I condemn you. Now go and leave your life of sin. If you're going to address someone caught in some sort of sin, let me encourage you with four questions. And I just put together a thought. Here's how you test yourself. Remember, Jesus waited until the very end to address the woman who was caught in adultery. He addressed the hearts of the ones who were, their whole purpose was to entrap Jesus and boy, just humiliate this girl. That's what they want. They wanted to humiliate her. They wanted to humiliate Jesus. Jesus turned it around and put it in their face. In other words, they needed to check their heart before they even started to think about pointing out someone else's sin. That's what we need to do. If we're really going to be ambassadors for Christ, we have to ask ourselves these four questions. Before I address someone else who is caught in sin, ask yourself, number one, am I taking more pleasure in condemnation or restoration? What do I really desire here? Do I want to destroy this person? It was clear, those teachers of the law, when they brought that woman in here, they wanted her destroyed. They would love to see Jesus destroyed as well. Am I taking more pleasure in condemnation or restoration? My guess is, if we would just ask ourselves that question, every time we begin to talk about someone else's and someone else's sin, it would end the conversation. Because what? We want condemnation. We want to make someone else look bad. Why do we do that? So we look better. You might also, with number one, just right next to it, get your finger off the trigger. Just get your finger off the trigger. When you hear someone else's sin, just get your finger off the trigger. Number two, here's another question. Am I being affected by peer pressure? Boy, are there others? Boy, have you begun to talk about someone's sin? You've heard someone else's sin, and then all of a sudden people say, well, I will. And all of a sudden there's this peer pressure building. Well, somebody's got to go say something to someone about it. Well, someone's got to say, well, then I tell you what, let's just tweet it. Peer pressure. Let me tell you what, don't let peer pressure drive you to go confront someone, because if you let peer pressure do it, you'll want to drag them in front of those people, and then you'll want to go back to those people and brag about how you did it, how you set them straight. Here's number three, you ready? Am I saying what Christ would say and acting how Christ would act in addressing someone's sin? Of all of them, and I wrote them, here's number four, you ready? Am I casting a Christ-like shadow on this situation? What a thought. Man, if you are dealing with someone's sin and you realize you're an ambassador of Christ, who is only an ambassador of Christ because God chose not to hold your sin against you, then when you show up to the situation, cast a Christ-like shadow. I want to invite Keith to make his way out here. And as we close today, this first sermon, I want to remind each and every one of us that we are the faces of grace. You coming, Keith? Come on, buddy. So we're going to sing Amazing Grace. Our altar team is going to be up front. And there are some here today that I said, you need grace for your past. There are others here that you need grace for today. It's your present. There's some who need the message from Christ today who says, listen, neither do I condemn you, but you also need the latter half of that statement. Therefore, go and sin no more. Shut it down. Shut it down. That's called amazing, amazing grace.